I don't know if I can tell you that much about Martin Prechtel. You will hear from him very soon, from his voice to our ears, his stories to our heart. I can tell you that he was raised in New Mexico on a Pueblo Indian reservation, that his mother was a Canadian Indian who taught at the Pueblo school, and his father was a white paleontologist. He was trained as a shaman in the village of Santiago Atitlan, Guatemala, and served the community there as a full village member. In an interview that was published in The Sun, Martin commented, "In the Guatemalan village where I lived, you don't belong someplace until your people have died there and the living have wept for them there, until a few of your generations have died on the land and been buried there and your soul has fed on the land. You're still a tourist, a visitor." Martin became a true and welcomed resident of the land. "It wasn't as if I owned the land," he said, "but I was an honorable renter who'd paid with grief, artistically expressed in ritual." Martin is the author of Secrets of the Talking Jaguar and Long Life, Honey in the Heart. He once again lives in his native New Mexico, and he is very much in demand as a teacher, writer, speaker, musician, and healer. He is here tonight to discuss his book, The Toe Bone and the Tooth, which is for sale in the lobby courtesy of our library store, and he'll be joining you after the talk there for the book signing. I brought Martin's book, Secrets of the Talking Jaguar, with me to Guatemala a year ago, and reading it touched me very, very deeply. Knowing he would be here tonight at the library has been very sweet anticipation indeed. Please welcome Martin Prechtel to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Buenas noches. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me? Oh, yeah. Oh, it's a Scottish accent it takes. All right. Oh, thank you for the introduction, please. Thank you so much. Well, I'm Martin. And these lights, I feel like I'm in one of those Guatemalan interrogation rooms, you know. Slapping my finger, making me tell him where all the guns are or something. But, well, I guess you have to see me somehow, so. Yes, I am blonde, and yes, I am not a Mayan, and yes, I'm a half-breed, New Mexican. And you know, New Mexico people, they don't think that New Mexico is part of the United States, right? It's an acquired thought from other people, and all the laws in New Mexico are suggestions. So I come from a very strange place, which is called Santo Domingo. It's a tiny little town of 2,000 indigenous people, but I am not from that town. I am not an Indian from that town, and my mother was stationed there as a member of our beloved BIA, which the Indians had the good sense to burn down the school. And she then got to be in the public school system, which was reinstated after that. And she became very popular among Native folk and very unpopular among non-Native folk because she took kids every year and got funding, and there's all kinds of things that were not so well reserved in those days, and was fired every year for her efforts of getting all the things we need. Hello, how are you doing? It's good to see your face again. All of you. And then when she got the idea, she said, "I'm going to take the same kids every year till 12 years in a row." And then they all graduated, 29 of them graduated out of 40, which is very big. In New Mexico, no Native American person had ever graduated from high school, period, much less 29 in a row. And because everybody else went, got married and went back and farmed, you know, back in the village. And then she dropped out of the school system and became teaching English as a second language expert, which was never heard of before in New Mexico. New Mexico, they have 19 different languages, Native languages. They have, they're considered to be 9. But if you ask an Indian, they say there's 19. And then there's a native Spanish speech there, which is actually an inheritance of Sephardic Jewish talk from southern Spain. And then there's different varieties of American English, you know, on the east side of the state. They all talk like they're from Texas, because they are. But I grew up not speaking English and thinking of English as the conqueror's terms. And the native peoples there all spoke Spanish as a second language, English being like, what is that? So my mother taught English as a second language or a third language, was very, very, very radical.
And she became very popular. As if she thought it up. Of course, she didn't think it up, but you know, it was good. And I was her advisor. I was a little boy. I was 13, 14 years old. And because I knew all the syntaxes. And no other non-native person of that particular village had ever known how the languages worked, because they didn't teach anybody. But I grew up with it. And there was no verb to be in the San Domingo talk, just like there is no verb to be in Mayan, and there's no verb to be in Navajo, and there's no verb to be in Hopi, and a lot of languages have no verb to be, which is a great asset. Because it cuts out 9/10 of depression. You know, what am I? You can say it. And what am I? Why am I here? Who cares? We're here. So let's go. You know. So to be or not to be is like, you know, sort of out of the question. But it's not a question. It's not even a question. Shakespeare is extremely short in Mayan and in San Domingo. And it's like, okay, where's the coffee? You know. So, but as a result, she had a very popular program because it worked out. And New Mexico, I spoke on the radio the other day here, and New Mexico is the first state in the Union, the lower 48, that had bilingual laws at its inception, which is why they wouldn't let it be part of the Union. They refused it something like 90 times since the 1860s on up, because they didn't want any of those damned natives voting, especially the Spanish speakers. So they wouldn't allow it in. They finally allowed it in, I think it was 1912. And it had bilingual speech rights, meaning that everything had to be published in more than one language, but it not only Spanish and English, but in the language of whatever was being spoken in the place it was being published, which is still the case, by the way. Just how we won our landfill problem next to my house in Ojo Caliente, because they had to keep publishing in Tewa and Keras and Spanish and English and French and Russian for the other guys living up the river who have recently immigrated. And it became such a problem, they said, hell with the landfill, let's go somewhere else. But my mother's program became so popular that she got, actually, they wanted to get rid of her, and they couldn't get rid of her. So the government always promotes you when it wants to get rid of you. So it promoted her to becoming the superintendent of such and such and such or other. And she became the leader of teaching English as a second language. And while she was doing this, all her students had graduated from the 12th grade, had gone to college, were getting teaching certificates, little known to the people who were in charge of the school systems. And then she got put into place as the vice superintendent of the Northern Pueblo Agency, which was an absolute placebo position, which had absolutely no responsibilities whatsoever. It's just they sent you there instead of Siberia. But the superintendent died. And she did not kill him, I know this for a fact, that I know of. I don't think she did. I hope she didn't. No, she didn't do that. She wouldn't do that, would she? And she assumed this position the very next week and got rid of all the child-beating teachers in the school system and put her students in the positions that they are now qualified for because they were all speakers of the native tongue. And she quoted that forgotten part of their law. So that's why they called my mother Napoleon. She was about this tall. I did not inherit her great intelligence or her great stick-to-itiveness in that sense because I never wanted to work in the system because after she did that, she died. She died 5 months later. May 11th, to be exactly. On Mother's Day. She died. Strangely, nobody knows how or why. She's 42 years old, and I was not quite 20. I was 21, and I was 20. And I said, I'm going to carry her torch, but I'm not going to work for the man. And so I ended up wandering, and I ended up in Guatemala. And those of you who like to read books and have read some of my poor attempts and better attempts and hopefully increasingly better attempts, who knows, know the story, which I will not bother you with tonight because we're tight for time. But I will tell you this. I was not going to Guatemala. I was not an anthropologist and probably never will qualify for one, according to rumor. I was just trying to go away from what was killing the world. I was trying to go away. I was basically a self-made refugee. My father, by the way, is still alive. He was a paleontologist. Now he's old and he's sort of like the thing they're digging up. He's got more character. He's become a textured human being, a lovely, crazy old man, crazier than me. But his mother was Irish. My mother's mother's people were, and father's people were all from Canada. I don't know them much. They were mostly alcoholics and people that killed themselves when I was young. They couldn't deal with white society. My mother was trying like hell to be a native woman in position, which were very unheard of in the 50s and 60s, if you remember back. It wasn't even cool to be an Indian in them days. In New Mexico, they didn't even allow you in restaurants, by the way. You couldn't go in if you're a native person. You couldn't go in a restaurant. You couldn't go in there. So I was a blondie, and I was a half-blood, so I could go and get the food and bring it out for everybody. But nobody else could go in, so I, of course, refused, because I'm going to be all proud, you know. But the guy said, no, we're hungry. Go in there and get it for us, you know. And I'll bring it. And I also looked old for my age, you know, because when you have blonde hair, everyone thinks you're white hair in a place where it was dark hair. So I grew up in a very strange, segregated society, which is no longer that way. You know, it's not. You can go to New Mexico. Anybody can go to anywhere they want now. So it's a good thing. But it's not like that everywhere in the United States. Don't kid yourself. You can go into North Montana and still Indians are not welcome in certain restaurants or other types of peoples. Depends on what you look like. And that's the case everywhere in the world, isn't it? So I'm not here to talk about that or to tell you that or inform you about that. But I'm telling you, that was the beginning of the times that I grew up in. And so the tendency would be to learn hate. That would be the tendency. I wasn't good at it as a child. I was so full of love that I wasn't good at hating. But I wanted to. I wanted to be a badass revolutionary, you know. I wanted to storm the Bastille, man. I wanted to take somebody. I wanted to find the bad guy, you know, and kill him. And fix it, and that was the end of it. Have us a revolution. And then we'd all be happy. And the older I got, the less... Well, I wasn't good at it, for one thing. That's the problem. If I'd have been good at it, I'd probably be dead right now. But I wasn't good at that. I was good at struggling. I was good at fighting. I was very good at a lot of things I want to tell you about right now. But I was most good at feeling. Feeling. And that was not popular in the United States. It was not popular. Matter of fact, it was against the law in certain areas. Especially in rationalist academia, which I obviously did not take that route, which my mother would have been very proud of. I have turned down lots of degrees because I cannot compromise myself on certain issues. So here I am, Mr. Martin, standing at the edge of the stage, feeling a little silly being way up here in the air when I'm normally down there running around with you guys. But I hope you put up with me. So I am Martin Preto. My grandfather is Swiss. My grandmother is Irish. My mother's people are all Crees and Hurons, which I did not grow up with and make no claim to great knowledge of their culture. I grew up with San Domingo, so I do have a great knowledge of their culture and will tell you nothing about it because they don't want anybody to know, which is why they still have a culture. By the way, and those of you that know what I'm talking about know what I mean. And I ended up in Guatemala, and ended up in Guatemala, ended up in a town, which I would say a little town, but it wasn't a little town. It was a big old huge town called Santiago Atitlán. Which, by the way, is not the name of the town. That's the name that the Spaniards applied to the town, which was a translation given by the Tlaxcalans, who were their shock troops. You hear all this story about the Europeans coming to Guatemala. Europeans, they say, were the Spanish. The Spanish only existed for a couple of years before the Spaniards, quote-unquote Spaniards, got to Guatemala. There's no such thing as a Spain. It was a synthesized thing, like Iraq. It was a synthesized thing like Iran. It was a synthesized thing like Syria. Or like Lebanon, these were tiny, tiny little groups of amazing people that were forced to be together against their will. And even if you go to Spain today, you'll hear a lot about it. You know, they're still fighting about it and mad about it and what you have. But the interesting thing is Isabella, when she sent our beloved Cristóbal Colón, you know, who was, by the way, half Jewish and also a displaced person, you will find that what is going on in this world is this displaced people being missionized by other displaced people trying to dig a deeper hole to fill the other hole of grief instead of staying put and say, my hole is deep and I will make a gift out of my hollowness to feed the holy so that my hollowness and my grief, I will stay put if I have to die or I stay put and I'm really from here. And that's what it means to be indigenous. It means to be from a place. It's the Latin meaning of it, you know, born within. So these poor Spanish people came. There were 500 or so when they got to Guatemala, but people forget about the 5,000 and 9,000 shock troops that they had. And the first ones were all mastiffs. They were armored, and they only ate human flesh that they learned from the Austrians, when they were trying to get rid of the Jews and the Moors in Spain. So they would send armored mastiffs. I mean, mastiff's pretty bad on his own, you know what I mean? When he's coming at you to eat you, but when they're full of steel and spikes, and they only eat people, that's, you know, I don't know. I would take off, you know. Because how are you going to kill it? And why would you kill it? And what do you do? Who ever heard of an animal attacking a human like that at the behest of another human? Mayans have never seen such a thing. And then the Tlaxcalans who fought with them were Indians who were dispossessed by other Indians and said, oh yeah, we'll help you kill all these other guys. And they came and they did. And so all the names in Guatemala are Tlaxcalan, which is a Nahuatl language, translations of the local Mayan terms for things. So the word Guatemala is a Tlaxcalan word, Guatemalang, which is the translation of the word Quiche or Panquiche, which means the place where a lot of trees grow. Because Guatemala originally was a great forested place, which to some degree still is, but everybody feels that way. And the Quiche people, who everyone calls the Quiche now, those are the people of Guatemalang, the people of the great forested highlands. The Tutuhil people, where I ended up and plopped my poor little pink bottom in those days, were southern Quicheans. But you can't tell them that because they don't like to be called that, you know, because you know how Indians are. All these white people make up all these linguistic terminologies for everybody and they've never heard about it. Which is like in New Mexico, where I grew up, Santo Domingo, that's a Spanish denomination. The anthropologists say they speak Karis. They have no idea what that word means. And as far as they're concerned, they speak Kewami. And the Mayans, they all have different languages, at least 35 basic language differences in Guatemala alone. And it depends how you count things. It can be anywhere from 100 to 1,700 village dialects interspersed in there, some mutually intelligible and some not. And that doesn't include Mexico with highland and lowland dialects and all the Chortis and the Acalangs and a few of the scatterings in Honduras and a couple of the guys that are hanging out in Salvador. So I would live with one little place that speaks Tutuhil. So my poor little language is just this one little language. I speak two other dialects, but I don't want to boast because that's basically, you know, understandable. So I want to make a little prayer for you right now and for all of us, just so you can hear the sound of the language and to give a gift to this magnificent word prison, the Los Angeles Public Library. I mean, it's such amazing. You can hear all the words in there. It says, Martin going to bust us out tonight, you know. You know, I'm not going to bust you out tonight, but I'm working on it. It's okay. No, I love libraries. I love libraries. I think this is from, I get it from my mom. And my Irish grandmother was not a terribly known woman in the world, but she was so literate. She was so beautifully literate. She wrote to all her relatives in Ireland, and just this beautiful script, you know. And she was not loquacious like I am, but I know I inherited that gift of gab from her. So in honor of all of your ancestors and mine as well, especially your diverse ancestors, all of your diverse ancestors, the one you never talk about. That's not hip anymore, you know what I'm saying? That one as well. Because none of my ancestors are hip. All my ancestors are unhip, but they're all what makes a being like this, so, with short legs and a big mouth, and, you know, big chest and a lot of appetite, and a big hug. Can I reach and have rat and no lodesh canakan ramakavra? No can a child babe, can't capish kush kitch watch wash a shape, kush, mushushka vika watch ami ala liquor up in the Katsama. Kilabutsila butsla bakalo, the Melatakasima, Maholovlo, Oshlahul, Matushil. And some of you like to say different words from different places. You can say some of this word with me. You can say Ki'il,
Ki'il,
Utsil. Utslach be. Uslach lo. Nimlachtak. Asliman. Mahonlov lo. Oshlhu. Matyushil. Hahala. And Kabankamik. Okpinak. Shokvinak. Mahon. Kutakinta. Mahon. Shtkosihuna. Mahon. And Kayerich. Lovlo. Utsil. And Kayerich. Chuchchiliv. Long life. Honey in the heart. No evil at all. 13 thank yous. We, the 800, shimmering amnesiacs, today, like flowers and sprouts, long to sprout at your roots. Old woman, old man, long to flower in your branches, to be held in your arms. We, the 800, shimmering amnesiacs of the Milky Way, long that all our failures and all our tears be seeds that fall in the ash pile of our confusions and jump up and bust out the seed to lick the face of sky, to plant a time beyond our own. Then long life, honey in the heart, no evil. 13 thank yous. That's what you said in Maya when you said it, so you have to say a little bit. It's a wonderful language, but all languages are wonderful languages. And when you lose your languages, you get sad. Because you obviously, when you lose your languages and you're speaking, you're obviously speaking somebody else's language, which means that it's a conqueror's tongue. And it doesn't matter what color your skin is. Because no matter who you are or where you're from, if you're speaking a language that ain't your ancestor's tongue, there's a little piece of you that's a little bit sad. And so the people that have funny little accents in English, like myself, you might have noticed that I speak English a little bit differently than the guy in the news programs. That's because they all go to Ohio to learn, or Michigan or something. I think they go Ohio. I think they told me that. I don't know. There's like this training camp to talk flat. But it sounds like an accent to me, so because we, where I come from, we all talk funny like I talk. But the thing is, if you have an accent, that's a wonderful thing. Don't throw it out. Don't throw it away. Because that's the last teardrop of your ancestor's tongue. That's the last vestigial remembrance of that. If you're from Appalachia, if you're from Africa, man, don't throw away the rap. Because there's a deliciousness in there that keeps the world alive. And that's what English has become, actually a pretty good language in a weirdest sort of way, because everybody's way of speaking is strange. It's made it come alive despite the conquering that has been done. If you go to Jamaica, you hear the most beautiful English you ever heard in your life. Or Mississippi. Or, you know, you can try Roatan. And that'll give you a turn. Or there's some place up here called Boonville. I don't know if you've ever been there. They speak a Russian, Native American kind of strange English that's all mixed together, you know. It give me a cup of Zisman, you know. It's like, let's have a cup of coffee. A horn of Zis, they call it. So language is very important to me. Anybody doesn't like language, well, then me and you are just going to, until you do like it, I'm going to stay here. But the thing is, language is not only spoken. Most language is not spoken. And so written language among Mayan people are very suspicious. They don't like written things. They're all writing. I don't, all writing, you know. That's kind of like arsenic. I mean, we could have it, but like, why would we want it, you know? Because the people say, oh, but the Mayans had writing in the old days, and they still thought it was dangerous in the old days, too. So they had special people that just wrote for them. And they're called the Achtzip. Can you say? Achtzip. Well, you got to do, I mean, you can't speak Mayan and sit like that. You have to move your body, you know. Achtzip. You have to move your head, you know what I mean? Otherwise, you're going to explode your gut. You know, Achtzip. That's right. You got to move your head like Hungarians. Achtzip. Achtzip. That's right. Achtzip means painters. And to them, the words were never written, but they were all painted. Very much like in Chinese, where it's ideographic, but the mind literally painted them. Now, people who paint language, the word for painting, the word for color, this means play and smile, the word color. So that means the people in charge of the smile tool. But then, there was a group of people called the Ahuchang. which you can say ahu-chang. There you go. See, he's got it right. He's got that Yiddish method. Ahu-chang. You know, already, you know, ahu-chang. Because, and that means the people that spoke the written word. So if the word was written down, it was already dangerous. Because if it wasn't spoken out loud, it desired to be spoken out loud and created a debt against the writer of the word. And so that the word had to be spoken out loud every year. So every word that had been written in history had to be re-spoken every single year aloud again. So the people, what they wrote were very particular. They're not going to just write any old schlock, okay? Because it had to be spoken out loud. Because if it wasn't spoken out loud, the culture would entropy. And the words themselves become holy, and they're alive and hungry, and they would eat the writers. We are living in such a society right now where people fight over the written word, which is absurd. Written word must be spoken. So it's the words that you speak as they disintegrate in the air is their valuable piece, not the preservation of the written word. The preservation of the written word is not the valuable piece. The preservation of the word is not the valuable piece. The valuable part is the speaking of the words to each other and to the invisible. So when I was asked to write books, I said, no way. I'm not writing any books. Because I grew up in a society, no books allowed. In Santo Domingo, where I grew up, if you wrote a book, they will kill you. They killed three guys when I was in the 1960s for trying to write books. And they burned all the books written about the village, which is why there are any books about it. There's 300 of them in the Smithsonian Institution. And all the guys that have written those have disappeared. And the guys that were informing for them disappeared very strangely. So no one writes about them, including me. I do not write about them, which is why you don't see it in there. But that's not necessarily a good way of dealing with it. What I'm trying to say is I grew up with that stigma on my head, so for me to want to write was really a big old deal. Because I'll become a priest of the written and spoken language in the village of Santiago Titlang as Shamang, which everyone is very seems to be enormously interested in, but more interesting of the maintainer of the peace between the people and the holy, which was a priesthood position of which there were hundreds of positions. I was just one minor one, mind you. Which is very complex, and you can read Long Life, Honey, and the Heart if you're interested in any of that. But my point is that when I went back to Guatemala, a certain thing happened that convinced me to begin writing as an art. And I'm going to read you from a new book about that, if it's all right, because they want me to read a little bit, and I would like to read a little bit. But just to, before I begin, to let you know, I didn't write these books to be big. I didn't write these books to be happy, because they're not happy. I didn't write these books to make money, because let me tell you, it can't be done. But if you want to talk about the publishing business, I go talk to you out there, man. These guys are, it's a very bad situation right now. No, it's very bad for most authors, very bad with the distributions and things, how people are merging and micromanaging everybody out of their cash. That's why I changed publishers, in case those are wondering why I'm with Harper now, because they're treating me good so far. We won't say nothing else about the rest of them because I'm not that kind of person. But I am telling you that I wrote because I wanted to give the gift to you because I realized at one point that the bad guy isn't sitting over there necessarily and that the bad one isn't there and I couldn't kill the guy in the Bastille and make a revolution and things would work out because I would end up being the guy in the Bastille. And I would be the one that needed killing after that and nothing would ever work out as it works out. What's that is job security for the gods of war. Well, it is. You can look around and see how much of it you're paying for right now. Huh. So the terrible understanding became to realize that it was a syndrome that was killing us and that it was present in all people and that every human being have indigenous soul. And the indigenous soul lived in a place beyond what they knew. Because it had the memorial ability to remake the story again, to find its root. Not find its roots, not your ancestry. Because otherwise it's going to be Jews and Arabs again. Or the Hutus and the Tutsis. Not the ancestry, because when you start fighting over ancestry, you've already lost your indigenosity. Indigenosity goes beyond your ancestries. Includes them. But goes beyond them to what made your ancestors great. Now, there's a great tale I always tell, and it great peril to the time we have left. I might tell it right now very quickly. Oh, no, I shouldn't, because we don't have enough time. Someday I will tell you. Well, so many tales. It's not from Guatemala. You've probably already heard it anyway, and we don't have time. We're in L.A., you know. You're like, oh, we gotta go.
Yeah, well, we're gonna tell a story no matter what. It's just which one, you know. That's what I'm gonna tell you. So the point is that your ancestry is the thing that makes you fight. But if your ancestors were great, it wasn't because they could fight or because they had the word or they had the answer. If they were great, it's because of what was in the ground, the invisible holy, and their relationship to it. And that has not been passed. In most cases, because it means you have to go through an initiation that goes beyond the tribalisms. So people who are tribal are not tribalist. Tribalism sets in when you lose the tribe. And you start guarding the church key, or the word, or the Torah, or the Quran, or the Bible, or God knows what. Especially when it's fixed instead of liquid. So I'm going to read something that refers to this. And strangely, this is really going to be strange, okay? This is the first time in history you can tell everybody you saw it here first. I'm not only wearing glasses to read it properly, because, you know, I look professorial, that way you listen better. But also, it's the introduction. I've never read the introduction out of any of my books. I always pick somewhere in the middle to befuddle you, make you read the rest. But I'm going to read this because it's very important for me to read it to you, because the written word must be spoken out loud. And if you want to do me any favors, if you like anything I do in this earth, read my books out loud to each other, especially to the blind. Especially to the blind. Especially to the infirm. Especially to the sick. Please do this. Because then these words will not kill me and won't kill us. Because reading them out loud, you know, your teacher in school said, don't be moving your lips while you read. Move your lip all you want. I give you permission. And hum while you eat while you're at it. I don't know. What the hell? You know, they tell you not to make sound while you eat it. It's ridiculous. Everything in the earth makes a sound when it eats. You ever seen a bear eat quiet with his mouth closed? You know, it's a neurotic bear. And the dog, you ever see a skunk not go, I don't know. Anyway, that's sort of off the subject. This is called Their Arms Outstretched in the Night, from a book called The Toe-Bone in the Tooth, which has just recently been published, and I'm very proud of it. And it took all my meat out of my spiritual gut to write because it's so heavy. But it's a good book, I have to say. The other ones, I said they were all right. This, I know, is a good book because it will live beyond me. It's for your children, my children, all that's ever been. After the terrible massacre of December 1991, resulting in the long-awaited removal of all the soldiers that had been permanently bivouacked in Santiago Atitlan for 8 years in the early spring of 1992. I returned for the very first time in just as many years to Guatemala and Santiago Atitlan. I was met outside the airport by 5 teenage Atiteco boys who had still been young children when I'd left the village. And in a little yellow Japanese pickup with the back window missing and the truck bed piled high with kume, or Mayan squashes, covered with a canvas, these young men had come to fetch me and drive me the remaining 90 kilometers to the lakeside where I used to live. Can you imagine what that felt like to me? Couldn't be there for years. They wanted me to sit up front with the driver while the rest stood in the back until we were due to pass an army or police roadblock, for which they had me burrow under the squashes and canvas with 3 of them seated on top during the inspection, by which ruse we were able to clear all 7 checkpoints on the hot Pacific coast before the steep climb past Patalul, the land of Zapotes, up to the cool highlands and on to the Mother Lake, or Lake Atitlan. At that particular time, from there to the village, the road would be left unpatrolled. When we entered the first profusion of volcanic hills and forests, the driver stopped the truck while one of the young fellows in the back, a distant relative of mine through my children's Tutuhil grandmother, inquired of me if it were true that I knew the story of the toe bone and the tooth, and if so, could I tell it to them from here on out as we drove along? The landscape we were driving through was the very story, and we had to proceed mighty gradually, stopping very often to allow me to tell the whole tale, pointing out all the places, the rocks, the rivers, the trees, the volcanoes, the animals, and so on as we passed each one. Certain mountains that we circumnavigated were actually part of a different story, to which they forced me to jump as well in between, only to return back to the toe bone and tooth after rounding the bend back into our original story. I suddenly recollected how the last time I'd ever been on this road, I'd been telling the same tale, albeit headed in the opposite direction into exile with my little family.
from the look on their enraptured faces that alternated between a surprise, thrill, and embarrassment. I wondered if any of these attentive Sutu Hill youth knew what came next at each stage of this powerful old story of their ancestors. I found myself asking them at intervals in the telling of the tale, and then I know it came. Do you remember? You remember, don't you? But none of them did. At one point, just before getting to the southeastern corner of the mother waters of Lake Atitlang, I myself got lost. The story didn't match the land, and I recognized nothing. I stopped speaking. We all stop speaking at some point when we don't recognize the landscape of the ancestor who comes back in a different form. For these boys, this road had always been this way. For me, it was out of the story, an unknown thing. Amazed at my confusion, the boys explained that an earthquake, several floods, and an intense forest fire had rerouted the river, reorganized and tumbled down two mountains. The road now slowly edged around the slope of yellow dust and fast-growing gravilea trees, swinging 200 yards west to what had been, in my time, pure air above a deep ravine. Another of the boys yelled to us, "Well, this must have been where the mountain god threw down the hills and tried to burn the raggedy boy. The mountain must have been angry for all our tearing up of the ground." In the interim of my absence, all these young men, either through their families as war orphans or by themselves, had been coerced by political circumstances into becoming Protestant Christians who expressly prohibited the old stories and any proximity with the people who might know them. As a result, none of the young people truly knew their own people's big stories, quote unquote, such as the toe bone and the tooth, but all had heard about them on the sly. Though they didn't know the tales, here in one telling, they were already inside their own story. This is what convinced me to write this. Remembering what had recently happened as part of what had always happened for thousands of years for the land and for their people, what was indigenous in them was still alive and ready to listen to the likes of me from far away who'd spent his entire life married to the meaning of these stories, which became my stories, stories that had been demonized by missionaries who came from the land in which I now lived. Arriving at the edge of the village at 2 a.m. on Wednesday, 10 hours later than expected, we were an emotionally charged and exuberant crowd of men as we unloaded one of the boys' squashes at his house at the bottom of the hill at Chinamya. Far off, but coming toward us in the night, we heard the shuffling of 100 bare feet on stones, the squeaking of sandals, the muffled hum of men and women walking behind the roar and squeal of the big village drum played by my old comrade, Akokesh, and a new flute player. That's what I used to be. I used to be the flute player, you know. It's a new guy. You see, these young guys, they know nothing about these stories. The Christians said, "You're not allowed to hear the story." And yet, when I didn't know the piece of the story, because the land itself had changed, they were able to transform the story according to the land when I couldn't. And therefore, I knew it was okay that the world had hope because the indigenous memory in their blood just latched right on to the old story, linked it up till I could pick it up to where it was traditionally, and kept it going. And I said, this could happen in all people's blood. Doesn't matter where they're from or how much like Custer or George Bush their head became. You know what I'm saying? You guys are afraid to say things. We're from New Mexico. We are. We're from New Mexico. So our lives are always on the edge. This was part. This village drum coming down the night, you know, this is pitch black dark. It's 3 a.m. We're supposed to have been there 8 hours ago, right? We were telling the story, we came in a little late. This was part of the ongoing ritual initiation of four young people that always coincided with the ecstatic and exuberant Mayanized Catholic Holy Week. On this night every year for hundreds of years, the old people and initiating chiefs and women had come to meet the young men right here on the northern shore of the village who would have just returned from the wild mountains on the south side of the bay. It was here on this day every year in the dark, under the almost full moon, that the boys in high spirits would paddle with great speed and rouse in a rousing return in several 30-person canoes, filled to overflowing with great bundles of evergreen branches trailing in the moonlit water. And God, that's the truth. I've been on both sides of that so many times. I had been in charge of this whole year-long ceremonial and involved in various capacities with it every year that I lived in the village. But initiation ritual ceased the year before I fled the town from this exact spot less than a decade previously. Hope and emotion wrestled in me until I noticed that the drum and flute player should have gone with the boys in the canoes. When they saw me, the whole entourage of old-timers stopped moving. The drum and flute ceased, and every one of them looked down the hill. You know, old Pip had to do, you know. The Nabe Kich, the first deer, my old friend yelled, Nishtatet Arhar Lachamartin. I still remember him saying that. Could that be you, O Martin? They always call me O Martin. Truly, old brother parent, it's me, okay? Natsraga akural naban katowa via nkosamaha. And he said to me, what did he say back to me? He said, oh, it's so nice to see you. Come have a cup of tea. He didn't say that. He didn't say that at all. He says, how come you're so lazy? Get over here, let's get to work. And I'll tell you the truth, he didn't actually say that. He says, it's been like you've been peeing for a long time out there. Let's get back in line. That's actually what he said, because people go after urinate during the procession and come back. And I'd been gone for years and years. What happened? You long pee, man. It was so great to be welcomed back like that, because it meant that you never left. It's one thing to cry when you leave. Everyone cry, pull their hair, scratch their body. And when you come back, say, hey, all right, get in line, come on. It's because they say you never were gone. I mean, they don't forget you. They recognize you. I was only 41. But they call me Old Martin since I'd been 22. Tearful and hysterical when we had parted years before, now my elegant, enduring old comrades welcomed me back home as if I'd just returned from an extended pee among the rocks. They welcomed me by letting me know they hadn't let me go. I was remembered, reassembled, remembered. As far as they were concerned, no matter how far I roamed or what we'd had to do to survive, I was still inside the story with them and had never actually left the story or the village. And that's what I want you to have. That's why I read this book, so you don't have to go around lonesome. Marching with the old folks again, we arrived at the lake edge where I expected to see the initiate youth of this huge Mayan town, their mentors, their chiefs, their branches, and their long, loaded, hand-carved log canoes beached on the soggy shore. But none were to be seen, nor would they ever be. No one expected them, for there were no longer any initiations. The government banned it and the missionaries banned it. But the old people, with their head cloths over their shoulders, their hands outstretched into the night toward the mother waters and her mother, the grandmother moon, commenced to speak the exact old words of ritual remembrance, as if the initiate boys had actually been standing there. Utskin sa achi utskin sa awachisha hawa kohila lak Allah he a I havra itzabule natare bi havra utskin sa nawa a anenin saknak poknak hiera havra kohila. It's good to see your faces again. It's good to feel your breath again. We, the 800 shimmering forgetters, the big trees and big vines, do not forget you, our new fruit whose seeds will be our remembrance planted in the deep humus of our passing. We do not forget you. We do not abandon you. Yesterday and the day before when we saw you, we thought the moon dropped out of the sky and so on. For those who'd been inside these old-time initiations, it was easy to imagine the tired boys standing there with the branches strapped on their back, dancing to our words under the loads, swinging in the lake breeze. Now the village did ritual after ritual to what could not reply or be seen by those who had never seen it themselves before. After that, only one half of the rituals were ever done again. But these were carried out so assiduously that the following generations who hadn't seen the other side assumed that by going through the motions, they were doing the whole thing. 50% of what was holy and necessary was missing. Those dedicated old beauties were the last generation to know the difference. How much of the many religious and spiritual approaches in the world are actually extravagant later outgrowths of the tiny treasured bits that displaced people, overrun or driven to disperse from their homelands, could carry in their arms as they fled, leaving the greater portion of their big stories, rituals, and understandings still waiting in the long-lost ground of their origination? Are most of the allegorized, dogmatized, literalized, sanitized, boring, overly historified rituals and written stories only jealously guarded fragments of a pushed-aside indigenous intactness, which all people in this increasingly displaced world have hidden somewhere in their bones as an unremembered legacy in which an intact living story still waits to come into view? For if, as my old Sutuhil friends used to go on about, our human bodies are actually the earth itself, then somewhere inside this earth body, our homelands still await our return. Inner homelands, in whose soil our indigenous souls lie ready like seeds. Seeds whose DNA are the big, culturally intact stories. Seeds that have waited for thousands of years for the spiritual climate to shift enough to where the tears of our human grief about the day we finally remember the overwhelming magnitude of our diverse, earth-oriented cultural loss could moisten the seeds of our big story. Moisten the seeds of our big stories, causing our indigenous memories to sprout again into well-rooted trees of remembrance upon whose branches a never-before-seen fruit, a new possibility for humans on earth, might come into sight, remembered beyond its own recollecting into a time beyond the already known and limited imagination of the age. Some stories, however, like the toe-bone in the tooth, sometimes refuse to wade in the ground like seeds. And without the old rituals where they used to live out their lives, they show up in the most unexpected places, like Los Angeles, under bridges. If you read this story, there's so much of Los Angeles in here, because I plopped down in here when they came back from Guatemala. It's a heavy thing for me to come back here and be welcomed by you on a stage when we were hated and thrown away. It's amazing. So it's a big thing, that's why I like to read this and take my time. Let me just say that again. Some stories, however, like the toe bone and the tooth, sometimes refuse to wade in the ground like seeds, your stories as well. And without the old rituals where they used to live out their lives, they show up in the most unexpected places, under bridges, in wars, at the job, on the street, hitchhiking, living out that big story in extraordinary ways inside the lives of ordinary people anywhere who, like refugees, learn to live any way they can away from their homelands. The earth itself never stops talking out its big story. It is the people who stop listening. The earth is always talking. The big story, capital big story, the big story needs the earth to hear its tale, and the people need the story to be well on the earth. But that means we have to have good open ears to listen. The indigenous soul hiding inside us has just such ears. This book is an account of the old Sutuhil mythology of the toe bone and the tooth as it lived itself out in my own life, a life spent trying to keep this story alive and remembered. When the spiritual landscape of the Tutuhil Maya it was born from was dismembered by the troops of the same syndrome of cultural amnesia that has caused all the diasporas of the world. The Jews, the Armenians, the Africans, the Poles, the Samis, the Siberians, the Mongols, everybody has experienced it. This book is not only about Mayans or Guatemala, Americans, America, or the English. They're in here too. Had to get them. It's also, I love things, don't get me wrong. It is about how long it takes to become a human being. This book is not only about Mayans or Guatemala, Americans, America, or the English. It is about how long it takes to become a human being. It seems to say that humans are most useful to the universe when they are blessing, especially when the unblessed in the culture become the blessers. And when humans give their gifts to what they cannot see with their eyes, when they turn the failure and grief of their everyday losses into life-giving beauty, and when they are in love. The toe bone and the tooth is a love story. And I give it as a gift to all those that love, especially to those whose arms outstretched in the night, who having given all they had left, speak alone to what they would have loved, and hearing only in reply the moon upon the water, begin to sing, and hoping the real one might appear. That's the introduction of my little book. So please. Matyoshchwa, thank you very much for listening to that.